I take it that means that you have begun your vision? Still in the inspiration part. I've got a pretty good idea of where I want to go, I admitted, where I logically and rationally should proceed. But considering my dabbling with alchemy magic landed me on my back, debating reality with a goddess the first time I tried using it, I'm feeling a little cautious about the plan. You can't learn from your mistakes if you don't make any, she pointed out. Thanks for the pearls of divine wisdom, I grunted sarcastically. This is going to be a hell of a learning experience, then. I'm pretty sure Master Asghuri will be game to assist, but I'm also going to need Onranian's help. That might be more problematic. The Elkan Council isn't exactly enthusiastic about letting him have his way with us half-civilized Humani. I'm sure you can work something out, she dismissed. The thing is, it's just one piece of the equation, so to speak, I explained. It's daring, it's ambitious, and it's dangerous. But even if I do build it, it still won't be sufficient. It would be easier to follow your reasoning if I knew what you were talking about, she suggested, her eyes locking with mine. I snickered. Oh, is someone upset by obscure hints and ambiguous pronouncements? Now you know how we mortals feel when we deal with the gods. I think I know how to challenge the dead god, I said, or at least how to build the device that will challenge him. Or part of it. Part of it? Sherul has enormous power, I agreed, but he also has other tools, means of expressing and directing his power, like he did to freeze the Poros. Without a way to match that, it won't matter how much power I can get out of the thing. I can't help but wonder if the rest of the answer doesn't in fact lie with the gods. I trailed off into thought. This particular god is a bit confused, she confessed. What the hell are you talking about, Minilan? We need some leverage, I said, enjoying the idea of keeping a goddess in suspense. Whether it's against the Gavani and Sherul or the Alka Alon or whomever else, we need leverage, and we just don't have it. The power is helpful, but without a fulcrum and a lever, no leverage. Brilliant metaphor. What does it mean? It means that I want to try something dangerous and stupid, I said, suddenly eager. Inspiration had struck. If what you say about my mind is correct at the moment, and who am I to doubt the word of my patron goddess, then I'm wondering if I can't try to use that to at least create a fulcrum. You want to try magic? She asked skeptically. While you're unconscious and in a feverish state? At the exact center of the magical vortex you created? Minilan, I'm not sure that's a good idea. I laughed. Of course it's not a good idea. It's a very bad idea. But it's also the only chance I'll get to do something like this, and I have the great excuse that I was unconscious and out of my head the whole time. Min, she said, her tone sounding like a mixture of Pentandras and Alias, what are you planning to do? Let my subconscious mind guide my magic, I explained. I can't consciously construct what I need to. I have no idea how to do it. But I didn't consciously construct Snowstone either, so there's certainly the possibility it will work. What will work? She asked, exasperated. That's the thing, I smiled. I have no idea. I'm going to hook my subconscious mind into your divine inspiration, feed it power until I can't anymore, and see what happens. If my theory is correct, then my subconscious will supply the form and fashion of what I need, and my divine patroness will supply the inspiration to make it work. My divine patroness studied me. You are mad, she finally said, shaking her pretty head sadly. Utterly mad. Yes, I sighed with satisfaction. Now let's put that madness to work and see what happens. Stoke up that fire, goddess. If flame is transformative, I want a lot to work with. The details of what I did, locked in my own head, elude me. I know that fire was important. I know that various runes of imperial magic and snatches of Alkan song spells were involved. Some of it was cribbed from the spell that had inadvertently created Snowstone. Some was wild magic, spewed forth by parts of my brain I didn't know exist. I allowed my desire to fill me, and transform itself into will. Will without form or structure. I knew what I needed. I just didn't know how to put it together, consciously. But I gave my brain all the encouragement it needed to figure it out while I wasn't paying attention. The entire enchantment built up around me, encircling the forge, the goddess, and me, until the clearing was swirling with power and magic. The fire leapt into the night sky, challenging the strange stars and mocking the too bright moon. The heat of the forge swept over me, engulfing me in its volcanic embrace as it raged from the fuel of magical power I was feeding it. Minilin? The goddess of fire asked in a shaking voice. What are you doing?
I have no idea, I grunted,
as the arcane forces of my mind shot into the forge and began to work without my guidance.
But it seems to be working.
She didn't speak again for a while, as the imaginary forge transformed from the block of stone to the altar under the Everfire in Brigger's Temple in Sevendor Town. From within the column of flame I could see an object, the construct of my unstructured desire, made manifest by the depths of my subconscious. Finally, when the energies I was working with built to a pitch, Brigger quietly laid her arm on my shoulder, and I felt a wave of divine magic wash through me. That was enough. That brought the construct to final form. A burst of light and sound and heat exploded from the altar, leaving a diminishing everfire in its place, and the results of my subconscious conception. A glittering snowflake of infinite, changing complexity hung above the ground, made of brilliant crystal.
That was impressive, Brigger said, as she stared at the creation.
Yeah, I agreed dully, as I stared at the thing. Pretty, too. I wonder what it does.
I wonder where it is.
You don't know, I asked, confused.
It was just created, she pointed out.
I don't even know if it exists in reality. It might just be in the other world.
Somehow I doubt it,
I said. That was just too draining to be a mental exercise. But it is pretty.
A snowflake forged from fire,
Brigger nodded, studying the beautiful artifact. In the mind of a mad spellmonger, I finished. It does have a certain elegance to it. And I like the symbolism of the snowflake.
Snowflakes are symbols?
Brigger asked, skeptically. No more than fire is, I shrugged. A symbol is what you make of it.
But this is it, I pronounced.
I understand.
I just don't know what it is.
It's the fulcrum I was speaking of,
I explained. And no, I don't know anything beyond that. I have a feeling I'm going to be studying it in depth, however.
There is one good thing about the exercise,
she pointed out.
What? Your fever has broken,
she informed me.
Your brain is starting to shrink a little. Who knows? You may even regain consciousness.
That would be good,
I decided. These strange stars are making me uncomfortable. She smiled at that but didn't comment.
In any case, I think that you've done all you can here. It's time for you to continue your journey.
I sighed. Isn't it always?
Which way?
She shrugged.
It's your head. Does it really matter?
It was a dark road at first, but after a little while, I noticed the skies above the trees lightening. Twilight. Dawn. I kept walking with renewed purpose, and soon every step was lighter. I realized that the sky was brightening above me, and the more I stared at it, the more it pulled at my attention. I could hear the birds in the trees and focused on their song, until I realized it wasn't really birdsong. It was a voice, a bell-like voice speaking a language I didn't understand, but whose meaning was tantalizingly out of my reach. The voice got louder, more intense, transforming into a more complex song that infused me. Alkan magic. A song spell. I remembered those. I paid rapt attention, trying to understand the nuance. Alkan magic was fascinating and elusive.
Repeat that last bit, I whispered.
He's awake!
I heard someone shriek. That wasn't part of the song.
My eyelids fluttered. Light from a pale mage light hung over me, reflected by the walls of Sevendor Castle. My bedroom. My tower. My home. There was a face above me, silhouetted by the light. A stunningly beautiful face with metallic-coloured hair. Lady Ithalia. Her song stopped abruptly.
Mage Lord?
She asked anxiously.
Minalan? Where's Alia?
I gasped, my head pounding, but not nearly so aggressively. Like a boisterous giant dog who had finally settled down to sleep, the pain had become manageable.
We've sent for her,
she assured me.
She will be here shortly. Do you require anything?
Water, I agreed. My mouth was as dry as an old shoe. The taste was reminiscent, as well. Someone held a reed to my lips and I sipped. The pure, clean water refreshed my mouth and aching throat like a spell. I could speak again.
How long have I been out?
What about the cook?
We took care of it,
the beautiful Alcan lady reassured me.
All is well, spellmonger. You have suffered a ferocious fever. The human brain was not designed to endure such punishment as you have inflicted upon it,
she chided. What do you mean? I asked, continuing to sip. I tried to sit up. My head explained to me what a mistake that was, and I reconsidered.
When news of your illness reached the Alcan enclaves, we emissaries returned to service. The men you hired were taken to Timberwatch through the ways, and have done as you asked.
Oh, thank Brigger. I sighed, settling back into my pillow. You would not believe the deposit that guy wanted. But what about the Kasari?
They are all well and secure. Just where you left them,
she informed me.
Lady Pentandra has stepped into your place to lead them, with the assistance of Captain Arborn and your staff.
And the refugees? She smiled at me.
What refugees?
I was confused. The thousands of orphaned children from Barone, who were expecting me to produce a miracle and save them from a short, desperate life of despair before a bleak and lonely death from starvation or violence.
Things have changed a bit since you fell ill, Mage Lord,
Lady Ithalia explained, managing a quite human-looking smile. She must have been practicing.
The spells you prepared were well underway before you collapsed. There are no orphaned refugees in Alshar anymore. And as for the Kasari, they have already begun to march east, toward the frontier. Indeed, the vanguard is but days from the border.
She said it so casually, and not at all like thousands of unarmed children were about to get butchered or worse. Nothing could have changed that drastically in the few hours I was out. Unless... Ithalia, I said carefully. Exactly how long have I been asleep?
Mage Lord, you were not merely asleep. You are paying court to death, but you have been unconscious no less than 9 days.
Chapter 24 Recovery. A lot can happen in 9 days, as it happens. After a joyful, tearful reunion with Alia and the children, a good breakfast of porridge and a much-needed bath, Sire Kay himself helped me up to my workshop and into the padded chair I used for reading and meditation. My body was still weak after my fever. My brain had swollen, Lady Ithalia explained as she followed me up. That was what had eventually made me take ill. All the waypoint transportation I'd been doing. It was interesting, in a morbidly arcane sort of way. When a body comes through a waypoint spell, it is forced to suddenly adjust to the angular momentum of the world below its feet. The resulting jolt forces the brain against the skull for a brief moment. One of the reasons the spell produces nausea and a flash of panic. A bit like being punched hard in the head without the pain in your face to distract you. The brain heals, of course, with time and rest. But I had been using the waypoints so frequently and so often that my brain hadn't had time to catch up. At a certain point, it began to swell with the inflammation, and I had slipped into darkness. Had I not been treated, it was quite possible I might not have returned. That was frightening, even more frightening than facing a dragon. At least you usually see the dragon coming.
The Alcaalon had expected me to use the ways, but they hadn't anticipated just how much I'd come to rely on them for the march. The key to my recovery, they said, was more rest and a course of herbs that would reduce the inflammation and promote the restoration of my neurology. Alia and Estret and the other ladies of the castle fussed about me as much as I'd let them, and Sire Kay did his best to screen the number of messages and dispatches that were arriving for me. It wasn't restful, Lady Athalia insisted, but neither was sitting there uninformed and anxious about events. My body didn't want to move after 9 days in bed. My mind was still clouded, and I was unable to do more than simple magic. Not even mind-to-mind communication was possible with the herbs I'd been given, and no one around me wanted to give me any details. The longer people tried to take my mind off of my worries, the more anxious I became. Enough! I finally said, irritated, when Alia tried to put a pillow under my feet. If someone doesn't tell me what's going on in Alsha this instant, I'm going to start walking there myself. It was a hollow threat. I doubt I could make it down the stairs unassisted, but it got people's attention. Sometimes it's good to be the spellmonger.
Fine, Alia said, hands on her hips. If you must know, Pentandra is leading the entire march to the frontier even now. They will be there the day after tomorrow. The local barons have assembled a force of nearly 200 lances and hundreds of archers at the border checkpoint to intercede. Now that you are awake, and yes, everyone there has been informed, she plans to stop tomorrow and reassess her course of action. Are you happy now?
Happier, I conceded, considering the intelligence. 200 lances, you say? At least, Mage Lord, Sire Kay affirmed. Most of 2 baronies have turned out in response to the crisis. His Highness is adamant about Alshari refugees in Castal. Despite your absence from camp, certainly not missed by his spies, he still believes you are the one behind their advance. And there is more. Word of a large contingent of mercenaries moving west along the road, apparently in support of the prince's troops.
That is interesting news. I agreed.
Thank you. I feel a little better about things now. The march hasn't fallen apart. They aren't starving. Gareth is overseeing the provisioning operations from Timberwatch, Sire Kay assured me. The man you hired to lead the effort is apparently uncannily efficient. That's why I paid him as much as I did. I nodded. So, no starving kids?
No, Mage Lord. He promised. All are well.
There have been deaths, from what I hear, my castellan reported, but they have been few for a host so large. So, all I have to do is sit here and rest, and wait for Pentandra to consult me?
That seems to be the case, Mage Lord,
Sire Kay agreed gravely.
And that means rest,
Alia emphasized. Not experimenting, not enchanting, not reading, not talking, not writing, not planning, plotting, scheming, or even idle daydreaming. Do you hear me, husband? She said warningly. She only called me that if she was really mad at me or really aroused. It would have been comical if I didn't hear a desperate note in her voice.
I will, I promise,
I agreed with a sigh, at least for a day or so. I really don't feel like doing anything more strenuous. And now that I know things in Alshar are going well, I don't mind a bit of a nap.
Says the man who just slept for 9 days straight, Alia said a little shrilly.
I'll rest, I promised. I don't want to go through that again. Besides, if I did, I'd miss how all of this turns out. I did rest for an entire day, sleeping a few hours and then waking up. Just long enough to drink more disgusting herbs, a little watered wine and some broth. Then I'd nod back off. I think they lace the wine, knowing I'd finish every drop. But every time I awoke, I felt stronger, less frail, and more alert. My muscles began to unstiffen, and I was able to walk across the room and then up and down stairs. Going to the garderobe by myself was an event. By the end of the day, I felt strong enough to resume my link with the witch sphere and do some light thaumaturgical exercises. Just as Athalia had warned me, my brain was still recovering from the damage it had sustained. It hurt to do magic. I cursed myself for not paying closer attention to it, but at least it was healing. As helpful as the treatments I was receiving were, there were some war magic spells I knew could assist the process. When no one was looking, I cast a few. But the thing that made me feel better the most was something utterly unexpected that happened that morning. My father poked his head into my workshop.
"Dad, what are you doing here?"
I asked, surprised and startled. I'd just seen him. 10 days ago? 11? But that was back in Talrion-Boreen, not... "Your mother and I decided to take a bit of a holiday," my father grunted, as he pulled himself up the narrow stairs and into the room. "I wasn't fond of the way the castlemen treated my shop, and when the Baron rescinded my license."
"He what?"
I asked, shocked. Baron Lethar was getting old, to be sure, but I could not imagine him inflicting politics on a long and trusted vendor like my father. But that's just what he'd done. "He had the order from the Duke himself, it said," Dad grumbled as he found a stool and pulled his portly body onto it. "It's also been said that it's a highly temporary thing, that when the trouble blows over it will be restored without prejudice. It's not personal, Min."
"It damn sure is personal," I said angrily. "The Prince's problem is with me, not you.
He is just doing what men of power do. Using the means at their disposal as leverage," my dad reminded me. "The same as you do, or I, for that matter," he added proudly. "Well, to be fair, there's not much you can do about it, Dad," I said a little gently.
"Actually, in my way, there is," he chuckled. "Don't dismiss my power just because I'm not a wealthy lord or a crafty wizard. There is power, and then there is the power you get from knowledge."
"How so?" I asked, genuinely curious. I hadn't considered my father an authority on the subject of power, but I was suddenly very keen to hear his insights. Brushes with death do that.
"You serve a palace for more than 35 years, you get to know its secrets," he explained, sitting on the edge of my bed, "and how one thing relates to another, and what happens when certain things don't get done the way that they're supposed to, or certain people don't get paid when they're supposed to. Not to mention the fact that if the village and castle want bread, they must bake it themselves. At the premium price, the mill charges everyone but me."
"That seems like a pretty small thing," I said sadly. "There must be something more you can do."
"It's being done, son," he assured me. "After the raid, your mother and I decided to come see our grandchildren on holiday in Sevendor, and live with my son, the rich Baron, for a few months. And we brought everyone else in the family too, and every apprentice. The shop at home is locked up tight and the ovens are cold. And cold they'll remain," he continued resolutely. "I've asked the Temple of Brigga to issue a writ of prescription against the barony for its unjust behaviour against me. If it is granted, that means that no leavened bread will be able to be baked there at risk of Brigga's curse, and no smith will be willing to light his forge for so much as a horseshoe nail. No fosterlings will be taken, no candles made from wax. It's not a harsh response, but it will be a great inconvenience to the barony.
As it happens, I've developed a close relationship to the priesthood of Our Lady of Rapid Oxidation, especially Abbess Parsley at the Charvaline Abbey at Wilderhall. She might be well disposed to your request.
But, Dad, your shop?"
It pained me to even think about it. That shop had been my home and his career since he'd gotten his journeyman papers. It had to be killing him to see it shuttered.
"Or not?" "My shop will remain closed while my wife and family and I take a well-deserved holiday," he said defiantly, "sponging off of my rich and powerful son in his beautiful little valley. My son, who apparently owns everything in sight," he added, looking around the room.
"Well, to be fair, you can't see much from the tower," I said lamely.
"Just a couple of mountain ridges, castles, villages. That's a lot more than I ever envisioned for you, Min."
"Honestly, me too, Dad," I admitted. "Most of it was an accident," I confessed. just the result of people being grateful for me doing some unlikely things. It's also cost me a lot, in many ways. Honestly, sometimes I wonder whether I'd have been better off as a baker.
It's a hard thing to question the will of the gods, he sighed. You would have been a good baker, I have no doubt. But you love magic, he pointed out. You really do. As much or more as I love bread. And that's fine, son, he assured me. That's more than fine. A man who can discover the thing he loves most in life is almost as fortunate as the man who discovers a woman he can love. You don't have to love baking to make me proud. I understand what you see in magic. And you're as talented in your art as you could ever have been in mine. It's sufficient, he pronounced, to see you doing well at what you love. I don't need to see you doing well at what I love.
I do love magic, I conceded, and I've been very fortunate to have discovered that. And I am good at it. Not the best, even if I'm the most powerful. But if the gods have set this path for me, and given me both the talent and the interest, I feel compelled to follow it, even if it leads me into some strange places, like tramping through backwoods Alshar with a couple of thousand children, or facing off against a dragon. It also lets me do some pretty impressive things, too.
Like turn a mountain and a castle white, he offered, smiling, or stringing the place with those magical lights until a man doesn't know what time of day it is. I've heard about what this place looked like before you got here. It's a wonder what you've done here.
To be honest, I feel I've neglected it too long, both the domain and the rest of the barony. After this march is completed, one way or another, I think it's time I devoted some attention to the place. If you think it is a wonder now, just wait until you see what I've got planned for it, including the world's best bakery. But other things, more impressive things.
Just wait until the new mountain fortress is completed, I promised. Just wait until you see what I have planned for the town and the countryside. In Sevendor, I can use magic in ways that haven't even been attempted since the Magocracy, I boasted. And because it's Sevendor, I can experiment with things that the Arch-Magi couldn't even imagine. Not to mention secular power, he added. My son the Baron. It was astonishing enough to learn that you'd been ennobled, but a baron? A peer of old Letha? That's impressive.
My craft has been fascinating, and it's purchased me some security. Security I hope I haven't injured. It's not usually a good idea to make enemies of your liege lord, I observed, yet I fear I may have done that.
It's purchased more than that. I know what you've done here. Your people are in awe of you. I'm proud of you for that. You could have been one of those snot-nosed aristocrats, as useful as a fairy cake. But you're a 2-pound loaf as a lord. You've done better by your folk than even old Letha has with his, and he's counted a good lord by one and all.
He doesn't have magic on his side, I pointed out, or as much money as I do.
As to that, my father said guiltily, when we came, your wife put us all up in a fancy hall, in a brand new hall, apparently, in the Outer Bailey. She gave us the whole hall, and didn't ask a penny.
He sounded troubled and indignant about it. My dad was an honest man.
If she had, we would have had words. You are my family. You will pay for nothing while you are here, I promised. If you've been forced out of your shop because of me, then you stay at my expense.
I'd hesitate to say forced, Dad said, smiling. I'm on holiday. More, I'm enjoying not being a slave to the ovens for a change. And honestly, I couldn't help but notice that you lack a baker here. I thought I'd help my sons-in-law set up a proper bakery and make sure it's running before I go back to Tauri. Assuming the prescription is lifted by then, he added. His eyes twinkling.
And Mama is all right with this? I asked, surprised. Are you kidding? Everyone here treats her like a noble. Except her daughters, of course, but that was too much to expect. The lads are enjoying the break after that bit of work you had them at. In truth, they're looking to spend some of that extra silver they made in the last few months, which is why we're considering sites around Seven-Doored Town for a bakery. A model bakery, with even better ovens and layout than I have in Tulry. Different, of course, as there's no river traffic here, but, well, I have to do something, don't I? He asked, suddenly looking a little desperate. It's the curse of success. My shop is overflowing with bakers. I've stopped taking apprentices myself because your brothers-in-law all have them now, too. Is that a problem? I asked. It didn't sound like it would be. Considering, I'm considering retiring, if you want to know the truth, he admitted. But who to leave the shop to? And retire and do what? So this little holiday really does help me out, he explained. I can figure out who to set up here in Sevendor and who to leave in charge back in Towery when the time comes. All the lads are deserving of it, but this way I don't have to choose as harshly. Might take a year or so before we get things working right, he said apologetically, but when we're done you'll have the best bakery in the country. I trust your judgment. Whatever kind of bakery you want, assume you have a license for it. He grinned and slapped my leg. That's what a father likes to hear, how his grown-up son has learned to use nepotism and family connections for the profit of his kin. Then he got a little more serious. Oh, and whatever it was that you did to nearly die and lie there asleep, worrying a year off my life every day you slept, don't do that anymore.
Yes, Dad.
Dad wasn't the only visitor I had that day. As much as Sister Bemia and Lady Athalia insisted that I be allowed to rest, Master Goody came to see me, his face more troubled than I'd expect.
Min, he grunted, eschewing titles and other formalities. You're looking better. Thought we'd be turning that mountain into a tomb there for a while. It takes more than a concussion to keep me out, I said defiantly. How goes the construction?
Oh, well enough, he conceded. We've been working straight through, day and night, bringing out 3, sometimes 4 blocks a day. The guide tunnel is almost done, and, well, that's kind of why I'm here. We, found something.
Found something? More magic rocks.
We're not quite certain just what it is, he said, troubled, as he tugged at his beard absently. We do know it wasn't there a few days ago. But when my lads went down to the shaft, they're digging in the southeast side, they cut through into a vesicle and found,
he said, trailing off, clearly having a difficult time describing it. I had an idea what it was, though. A big, perfect crystal snowflake, about 3 feet wide, that keeps changing its form, I offered. The Karshak looked at me, eyes wide, mouth open.
How the hells did you know? He exploded. You've been unconscious since before we dug that shaft.
Don't worry about it, I dismissed. I, kind of created it, I think, while I was unconscious. There was a dream. It's all a bit hazy, but I'm pretty sure that big snowflake is my fault.
Well, what does it do?
He demanded.
It's made out of that quartz your spell affected, only it's like the crystal is alive.
It's a magic thing, I explained. What does Master Ashguri say about it?
He's still singing it, grumbled Guri, but he thinks it's like a molopar.
Molopar? Like a molopar,
the stone singer corrected.
It's got a lot of the same properties, but it has a physical form. It doesn't just hang there in space, not being anything in particular. I never saw one before, but my grandsire, he's seen a few. It's not exactly a molopar, but it's like one.
That doesn't make any sense, I pointed out.
You think?
Guri asked me, his huge nostrils flaring in frustration.
This is not covered by contract, Min. No one told me I'd have to deal with this sort of thing when I took this job.
No one mentioned it to me either, I observed. But the quick answer is that my brain made it when I was unconscious. It's a fulcrum, metaphorically.
A bloody fulcrum?
The Karshak asked, stupefied.
What the hell does that mean?
I don't know.
I'm making this up as I go along, I said, rolling my eyes.
Look, it's probably fine. Just work around it for now. Don't touch it until I can get down there and do a thorough thaumaturgical evaluation on it. When I'm feeling better and have some time, I'll take a look, I promise. But I don't think you have to worry about it. It shouldn't be harmful.
Compared to all of the other magical crystalline snowflakes I've found under mountains?
He challenged sarcastically. I didn't really have an answer for that. I had no real idea what the thing was either. I just knew it was important, and that I had made it. Theoretically, it should be a powerful tool to combat Sherul. Theoretically. By that evening, I was almost feeling normal. I'd restored my tissues with fruit juice and water, wine and broth, and moved up to bread and vegetable soup. I'd slept long and well, as restfully as possible. Alia would come in and lay with me for a few hours at a time, rubbing my shoulders and stroking my hair. I didn't begrudge her that. If I had nearly lost her, I would have been at least as attentive, and it was gratifying to wake up with her there, staring at me. A little creepy, too, but I didn't mind. It's one of the benefits of married life. That night I awoke long past midnight, my bladder issuing urgent demands. After tending to them, I realized I needed to do something else pressing, though in the realm of the spiritual, not the biological. I left Alia wrapped in our sheets, threw on a robe, kissed both babies as I left, and wandered down the stairs into the great hall. It was all but deserted at this hour. I crept past the great white fireplace and around to the alcove that housed the small castle chapel. Lighting a couple of candles in front of Brigga's statue on the altar, I invoked her with my accustomed prayer. She appeared within moments in a gout of flame. Flashy. Now that's divine service, I chuckled.
Minilan, you're better,
the goddess said, looking relieved.
Better than who?
I quipped. I'm only feeling a little bit dead now, if that's what you mean. But I am getting better. How fares the quest?
Better than expected, and in some unforeseen ways, she admitted. You seem to have a knack for this sort of thing. Even with you gone for a week and a half, your plan proceeded essentially as you wished.
Which means you produced that miracle I wanted, I asked.
In fact, I did, she said a little indignantly. More or less where you wanted it. A small settlement just outside of Lemsiddens.
Another magical pillar of fire? I prodded.
I could only manage that in Sevendor, she said, pouting a little.
Among other things? But it was a decided miracle. An aged priestess of mine who married a Kasari man happened to get struck by lightning.
Doesn't sound like your style, I said, frowning. I was in a hurry. I had to improvise, she said defensively. In any case, when she awoke, she found she now has the divine blessing of laying hands upon someone and foretelling that which they are most talented or favored to do, or most inspired by.
That's a miracle? I asked, confused. Any nun can do that.
Not with this precision, she said, shaking her head. She can tell you exactly what you'd be best at. If you have a special knack for the harp, for instance, she will counsel you to find one and learn. If you would excel in letters, she will tell you to learn to read. Or if you find deep, soul-abiding inspiration from ocean views, she tells you to seek the sea. Like that, she offered reasonably.
It sounds like simple prophecy, I said, frowning.
It is not prophecy, she insisted defensively, smoke curling from her hair. It's revelation. Big difference. Did you learn nothing at the academy?
I had one course in theurgy and I didn't pay much attention, I admitted. That was about the time I met Pantandra and I got distracted. I'm starting to give the field further consideration, however, I offered conciliatorily.
How enlightened of you, she said coolly.
In any case, if you say it's a real miracle, it's a miracle. The question is, does the temple agree?
When I told the High Priestess of Sharveline Abbey to her face, oh, by the way, I just arranged a miracle,
Brigga asked. A red eyebrow arched like a crimson chevron.
Of course she did. As you suggested, it was announced throughout the duchy as a recognized sign of divine favor by the temple. Now, any idiot in the world who wants to tramp all the way to a cabin in the Castali Wilderlands to learn he's destined to be the world's third best flute maker will be able to do so for a small donation to the local shrine.
I suppose that will do, I agreed, finally.
I'm so glad you approve, Minilan, she said sharply. Do you have any idea what it took to arrange that? It will be more than sufficient for your purpose. Now, if there's no other miracles you'd like me to do...
Actually, I said, foolishly interrupting the goddess of fire and vengeance, I guess I was feeling cocky, there is one little thing. Could you heal me?
What?
She snapped. You're a goddess of healing, too, I reminded her, for more than one reason. I'm recovering from magical head trauma. It's not a speedy process. I beseech you, O goddess, to lend your divine aid to my poor aching head, in the furtherance of your divine...
Oh, stop it before you get divine vomit on your slippers,
she scowled.
Yes, I'll give you a healing blessing tonight when you go back to sleep. But I want a favor in return.
The temple is already as large as we can safely make it, I warned.
The temple is... adequate,
she said with a sniff.
No, this is a personal favor. Remember when I said I wanted you to make another god permanent? You'll be getting that chance soon.
What? I asked. Who?
You should have realized by now that I'm not the only divinity involved in this extended parade,
she said carefully.
And while it's not my place to reveal such a thing, I should hope you're smart enough to figure it out. When you do, I think you'll agree that it's more than warranted. I just want you to consider it strongly. I think it would be helpful to us both. To us all, actually.
Is that prophecy? I asked warily.
Not my sphere, she dismissed. That was enlightened speculation. But I hope you'll agree our little experiment in divine mechanics has been successful so far. I think it's worth expanding.
I thought about it. If she meant who I think she meant, and they were who I thought they were, I shrugged. One good blessing deserves another. Heal me. We have a deal. I awoke at dawn the next morning, and I felt great. True to her word, Brigga's blessing had restored a great deal of my mind to health. My vision was clear, my limbs were strong, and there was no trace of headache anymore. Of course, not everyone was convinced. Alia insisted that Lady Athalia and Sister Bemia both examine me thoroughly before she'd even let me dress. But when they both pronounced me vastly improved, though neither would say the word healthy, many of my wife's objections faded. When I offered to demonstrate, in private, just how much better I was feeling, she grudgingly agreed I could go back to my magical quest. I began with consulting Pentandra, mind to mind. The connection was sharp and clear, and I could feel her surface emotions a bit, as well as hear her conscious words.
"It's about time you decided to return to the living,"
she said, when I made contact. "We're encamped 6 miles from the border with Castal.
Waiting."
"Waiting for what?"
"Waiting for you, mostly,"
she admitted.
"The Kasari are unwilling to go forward without you, once they heard you were awake and recovering."
"Recovered," I corrected. "I'll be joining you later today. Lady Athalia even approved limited waypoint travel, if I rested sufficiently afterwards."
"I'll let everyone know. But we're ready,"
she promised. "Arborn and I, Tyndall, Rondell, Dara, Ormar, Landric, Rael, Lelwyn, Brother Hotfoot, the priestesses, we're all ready for this.
Which is good,"
she added. "We just got a report that His Highness is considering riding from Wilderhall to the frontier himself to oversee its defense against the rabble, perhaps as soon as a few days."
"Oh, really?
You know, I could delay a few days, just so that we don't do this until he's there. In fact, that might be the perfect time in some ways."
"Min, don't go picking fights you can't win in the long run,"
Penny warned.
"You've already challenged him. Don't make this worse by making it personal.
We're going to have enough trouble from this as it is, she reminded me. I thought about telling her about the magical snowflake I had apparently grown while I was asleep with the help of a goddess. Somehow I wasn't afraid of an irritated nobleman. But then I decided against it. With what we had in front of us, and with her already feeling distracted by Arborn's presence, she really didn't need anything else to deal with right now. And as much fun as it would be, humiliating Tavard again in front of his vassals, I knew that it wasn't a good idea. You're probably right. I'd rather do it without him, if we can. Less complications, I decided. Can you hold the camp there for another day at least? Is there any danger?
Not to speak of, she agreed. We're well protected. The food is in plentiful supply. We can last another day without you.
Good. That will give me a chance to get a last few pieces into place.
Isn't everything in place? She asked. Or are there parts of the plan you haven't told me, as usual?
There's just more than one plan, I corrected. You know most of it. This is more political than magical.
Trust me, I said encouragingly. I know what I'm doing. Anybody else in the world might believe that, but this is me, remember?
Which is why you need to trust me, I repeated. I've listened to every word you've told me about politics, power, and all of that. I've been practicing it, too. I'm not adept yet, but I think I do know what I'm doing this time. We'll know in a few days.
I don't really have any choice, do I? She accused.
No, not really, I agreed smugly. I liked it that way. Chapter 25 The Frontier of Castal. I took 2 days to continue recovering before I finally appeared back in the camp. The emissaries were good enough to assist with the transport of a few guests in preparation, while Sister Bemi attended to me until it was time to depart. Ithalia insisted on doing the transport spell herself, to save my brain, and I'd conceded because I felt more confident in her song spell. Pentandra had told a few of the other staff I was coming, so that they could greet me before the Kasari mobbed me. That's why we appeared and met first inside Pentandra's elaborate pavilion. After the Alcan emissary was done with her duties, Ithalia examined me for a moment, pronounced me sound, and then took her leave. There were things happening in the realm of the Alka Alon that required her attention, she said. Pentandra solemnly assured her that she would not allow me to strain myself one bit. Penny had gathered most of the magical and command staff together for my return in her pavilion. It was a tearful reunion, and I thought all three of my apprentices were going to cry. One of them did. I won't tell which one. I greeted everyone in turn and listened to their well wishes and quick reports. Then Pentandra took over, and I was relegated to watching the organization I put together go to work, without need of me. I felt like a decrepit old man, the way they treated me. Actually, I generally felt fine now, just a little more mortal than usual. The staff was behaving as if I'd returned from the dead. I actually didn't expect the wave of sound that greeted me when I left the tent to inspect the camp before departure. Every child there seemed to be gathered, screaming and calling and cheering, all at once. That many voices were deafening. Arwydion y Fyny, Pentandra called, making the Kasari sign with her right hand. In moments, the thousands of children returned it, Kasari and Narasi alike, each one growing quiet until you could hear them all breathing.
Our spellmonger has returned, Pentandra announced, her voice augmented by magic. Tonight, we enjoy a meal to celebrate. Tomorrow we strike camp and continue down the road into Castal. Are we all ready? Bedish en Barod, came the call in unison, in Kasari, from everyone.
I looked out at the crowd. The true Kasari children were easy to spot. Apart from some wear and tear, they all wore the same uniform, hempen tunics they'd begun the journey with. Many had lost their cloaks or traded them to others, but they looked like Kasari. So did most of the 2,000 newcomers we'd picked up between Otter's Point and Tudri. Our efforts to equip them and teach them the Kasari ways had forged them into children that only another Kasari could distinguish from one of their own. Their clothes were a little more garish, less embroidered, and their gear less standardized, but from a distance you couldn't tell them apart. But the refugee children from Verone hadn't the time or experience to masquerade as Kasari. While they lacked the Kasari's resources, they had managed to each find a staff to carry them. They had found mantles and clothes, shoes and boots, and many had found packs to carry their belongings. They were more neatly dressed and well-behaved than the mob who had greeted us on the road. They were also better fed.
"We had to do something while we waited for the new kitchens to get set up," Tyndall explained with a grin, as we inspected the hundreds of orphans who filed in together and stood at attention in ranks, Kasari style. "So the rangers and the older Kasari started teaching the orphans how to live off the land, like the rangers do when they're in the wild. Which plants are good to eat, which mushrooms, which nuts and berries are in season and when, how to fish, how to trap, how to forage for eggs and such. Instead of starving, the children learned how not to starve, even when they have nothing," agreed Rondal, walking on the other side of me. "The hunters and the hawks were bringing back some meat, but not enough for all. We got some grain, but not much. But a little of it, stretched with the wild plants and such the children gathered, seemed to feed everyone for a couple of days. It was a few days of unusual cuisine," Tyndall chuckled, "but it kept everyone alive and hearty until the first few meals began to appear again from Timberwatch. By then we'd heard of your, fall. Everyone was worried, and it seemed to focus the attention of the new children. No one wanted to continue without you, so they just practiced. Learned how to survive on birds and squirrels, wild tubers and bark. But they learned." "And that wasn't the only Kasari skill they practiced while you were gone," Dara chimed in. "Pentandra made certain to keep everyone busy while we reorganized, and a lot of those orphans were pretty eager to learn. Just about everything. From reading to knots to sewing," she said approvingly. "I may have even found a few future skyriders amongst them."
"What about relations with the locals?" I asked, nodding down the road toward Verone. "Any trouble?"
"The local lords weren't very happy about it at first," Rondal reported. "No one likes having an army of children fouling up what little commerce is left in the region. But they've been very encouraging about seeing us over the frontier. So much so that they were persuaded to sell us some of their surplus. It was easier than having their herds raided from the air, I suppose. They're used to watching for raids from the Pearwoods clans, but the big birds unnerve them. There was one knight who insisted on trying to collect tolls from everyone," Tyndall added, "but I convinced him to forego the fee in the spirit of public service, and because I told him I would lead every child here to tear down his castle, stone by stone, if he persisted. He sounded disappointed that the knight relented. It sounds like you've taken care of everything while I've been gone," I praised. "In fact, I couldn't really imagine how things could have been going better. I expected ruin and misery. What I saw were a sea of smiling, happy, and somewhat dirty faces, and a couple of apprentices who were leading like grown men. That confirmed my decision."
"Yes, they've been helpful," Pentandra said from behind me. "Everyone has. But I couldn't have kept everything together, gotten everything done, if your apprentices hadn't been here. They're both being far too modest in their accomplishments, which I find suspicious."
"How unfair," Tyndall moaned mockingly. "Here we are, trying to do well by our poor old tired master, so recently risen from his sickbed, so close to death's chilling embrace."
"Old?" I asked, halting.
"What my colleague means is that the honour of the spellmonger of Sevendor was at stake, and we could do no less than our best under such trying circumstances," Rondal added diplomatically. "I assure you, we've had no ulterior motive beyond simple loyalty. My Skald and Fidlan."
"See what I mean?" Pentandra said wryly. "They're clearly up to something."
It was fascinating to watch the process. The camp was bustling with children beginning packing up their belongings and striking camp. Pentandra's patrol of girls hurriedly packed her baggage when we were down inside the pavilion, and it was one of the last to go. The children were eager to be underway now that I had returned. They had been instructed to take their place on the road as soon as they were dismissed from their duties, and the Kasari don't linger once orders have been issued. Each of the Kasari troops assembled, by number and by patrol, in an orderly manner stretching down the road for a very long way. The refugee children from Varone showed far less discipline, although they had picked up the social cue to be silent when the Kasari hand signal was given. The priestesses and monks, who had taken charge of them, had begun using it to help control the crowd of kids as they got them ordered for march. The refugee troops were more mobs than organized lots. They had adopted coloured sashes from the pile of rags that was left from the clothing I'd procured. The last of that had been distributed to the grateful throng from Varone, and the cast-offs were a little visually disconcerting. Many had created neckerchiefs, complete with woven rope brooches, in the Kasari style, and most groups had makeshift patrol flags like the Kasari. About 300 kids in each new group wore strips torn from the same coloured garment, and clustered around a priest or priestess, bearing a pole with a simple banner of the same colour. Some of the older children had been designated, or had declared themselves, leaders, and sported additional ribbons on their shoulders. I'm not sure how effective they were at actually keeping order, but it was better than the near riot of children who had greeted us north of Varone nearly 2 weeks before. To my surprise, there were horses waiting for us at the head of the column. I had expected to march. "Ithalia didn't want to wear you out with walking," Pentandra explained to me gently when I stopped abruptly at the sight of them. "Tyndall arranged to have them brought in from Tudri, and Astaroth says if you return that roan mare to him in less than perfect condition, he will find a creative way to respond. Apparently she's his favourite." "But I wanted to march with the kids," I said, nearly whining. "We've come so far together." "Don't be stupid, Min," she continued, in a voice too low for most to overhear. "You were just asleep for 9 days. You might feel good, but your body hasn't recovered, even for the few miles to the border. And if there is fighting, I really don't want you worn out. Besides, to make this work, you have to be a simple mage lord about his business. Speaking of which," she said, frowning, "we need to have some legitimate business for you to be crossing the border to pursue. Not that they'd keep you from crossing, with your rank and position, but if we want to—" "I know," I interrupted. "I have the perfect reason for me to be going to Wilderhall." I told her what it was. Her eyes got wide.
"Min, are you sure?"
she asked, swallowing. "Yes," I said confidently. "If this experience has taught me anything, it's that a man has to be willing to let some things go in order to keep things going."
It's just a big step. I'm not sure you're ready."
"You're worried about me."
"I'm always worried about you," she confessed with unexpected emotion. "Don't you understand? So much depends upon you now. Not just this, the march, the Kasari, the Peeled Towers, but so much more. What would happen if you died?"
she asked a bit shrilly.
"What would happen if you suddenly weren't there and I had to be in charge of this mess?"
she asked. There might have been tears in her eyes, or it could have been the thick summer wilderness pollen in the air. "It's time," I said gently, as I eyed the saddle. "We both know it is." Then I raised my head and said it louder, to different purpose. "It's time!" I called. "Trekmasters, prepare the troops for march." There was a sudden cheering as the Kasari children shouldered their packs and formed a line, 5 abreast, across the wide east road. The refugee kids tried to do the same, with far less orderly result. I allowed myself to be helped into the saddle of the big roan mare, putting my travelling staff, trailblazer, into the holster meant for a lance. Rondol and Tyndall rode their own mounts beside me, and Pentandra and Sir Festaren, Arborn, and our special guests riding behind us. Ormar reached me, mind to mind. "Sky riders aloft, spellmonger. Good to have you back, Minilin. It was getting boring." "Your holiday is over," I reminded him. "We still have a few 100 miles to cross until we get to the end of the trail." "I'm counting every bloody step," he promised. It was a pretty late summer morning, and we began to walk the horses at a languid pace to keep from outdistancing the marchers behind us. The Kasari rangers walked next to the ranks, bows strung but shouldered, eyes keen for any hint of trouble from the hedges. A few moments after we began, I sighted the first of Dara's wings circling south of us, high up enough to keep one from discovering just how big a bird it was. I was just settling into the rhythm of the horse's hoofbeats on the road,